As I said, about a little over 24 hours from halving, which means by the time our listeners and viewers are probably watching, the halving is almost certainly completed with success and low fanfare, or high fanfare but low volatility, let's say. So what do you think about that?
I think it will be a peaceful reduction of issuance, like we always see. Someone that kind of works adjacent to crypto that I was talking to this week was like, she was asking me, she's like, so for sure, does it happen? And I'm like, yeah, it for sure happens. And like, you could see the wheels moving in her head, like who pushes the button? Like who's in charge, right? And it's in the same vein of like the, yeah, Bitcoin's interesting, but who's the CEO? Yep. Which is like not an uncommon question.
Yep.
So yeah, it's happening.
That's happening. Very exciting. Last time was during
COVID. I think the last I saw was it would be like your Saturday morning and sometime pretty much middle of the night, East Coast.
I think it's actually going to be middle of night our time as of latest. I see 30 hours from now, 24 hours. It's like 2 a.m. my time based on latest.
Oh, so it's Friday night.
Yeah. But okay. You never know. Hash rate has certainly exploded in the last couple months in anticipation. Changed the date a little bit.
Hash rate's exploded in the last two years.
Sure.
It's been wild.
It's unbelievable.
I don't know where it all comes from.
Very exciting. And yeah, I think, like you said, I think it's going to be arriving peacefully, as it always does. But, you know, a lot of people on the talking heads are getting excited that we've had this little price drop in the last few days, thinking that, you know, this is either Bitcoin unable to respond to war volatility and war jitters. It's not a safe haven asset, as Andrew Ross Sorkin said over the weekend. I'm sure you saw that. You know, it's just in anticipation of the halving. It must be why the price is falling and miners won't be able to stay profitable and the world will end.
Yeah, I mean, people say all that stuff like people didn't know this was coming for four years. And these massive like mining pools have plenty of time to hedge and prepare. And, you know, you can make very savvy business predictions based on it. And I also think there's a lot of unwinding and transference of Bitcoin in the Gemini Earn settlement, which was approved by the judge this week. There's GBTC that was pledged as part of that on the Genesis side. There's the FTX assets. And so there's big tranches, and I don't always know, you know, who's moving what and when, but I don't think all of that's resolved either. And so some of these large movements we see are probably the unwinding or redistribution back to, or even positioning to be redistributed to the Earn creditors and the FTX creditors.
Yep. It's totally normal, and this stuff happens in markets. And, you know, we are just still so early on all of those things. So I'm, and that really bothers me or scares me or makes me feel like, you know, we're behind the eight ball there. Have you heard the latest numbers on how big the ETF pool is of Bitcoin?
I don't. I know that folks are speculating at approximately the current rate of GBTC outflows and BlackRock IBIT inflows, that BlackRock is within 30 days of taking the crown as having the most AUM. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I've seen that BlackRock, this was BlackRock's quickest AUM ascendance of any ETF they've launched.
Yep, it's breaking all the
records.
And
they're still, it's pretty impressive, right? And, you know, with 10 other competitors, and GBTC already had, you know, some, I forget what it was, over 30 billion in AUM, quite a bit when they started. So they have, BlackRock's absorbed some of that, but there's net new inflows to them as well. But I don't know what the total is. It must be over 40.
It's 74.35 according to BlockWorks at the moment.
Wow.
Which is huge. And the scale, the speed is incredible. It's also people may be interested to know the gold, all the gold ETFs in the world, is something like 100 million ounces, which is $250 billion or so. So, you know, you're already at a third of that. Pretty incredible in just, you know, less than half a year. So,
yeah. So it says here that GBTC peaked out at around 29 billion in AUM last year.
Yeah.
And they're down at 18. And BlackRock is nipping at their heels. Right. But if we think of GBTC as kind of the only proxy for what there was prior to the launch, then, you know, the net new inflows are massive.
Exactly.
Still.
Exactly. And, you know, same thing past week, price dampens a little bit. People, you know, the sky is falling. The Andrew Ross Sorkins of the world just love it. Absolutely love it. And it's clearly missing the forest to the trees.
Yeah. And so back to the gold though, what's your theory on, and I've seen several on the gold price
going up. Yeah. Well, I think inflation, war, all those things are typical. This risk off asset. And that was, of course, the little snarky type of a tweet that he launches. I mean, I'm just still baffled that this guy can get off on talking about, you know, Bitcoin on TV for all these years. Like, he's just one of many that have just been so wrong every month, every day, every year, talking about Bitcoin. But I am pretty much convinced that gold is out to pasture. And, you know, there's going to be a role. Jewelry is a huge part of the market. It's 50% of the market. It's still going to be. It's going to have ETF value. It's going to have some liquid value in certain times and places and cultures. But yeah, Bitcoin is just such a more supreme monetary asset that I don't see it lasting much longer. And actually, that brings me, we can look at, share my screen for you.
Well, pull that up before we get into it.
Please.
So you see the gold price as sort of like general secular acquisition of it, not any one particular buyer or you know, nation state acquisition or something.
Yeah. I you know, this is another thing to go in depth on at some point. Here's the, this is my top monetary assets worldwide. People have probably heard me talk about this, but porkopolis.io/top money. You can find it under money supply, first one. Basically, we go through all the base money stuff and everything, but we're breaking down the actual gold supply in ounces. And this number, Alec, it's going up a little bit. It I think bottomed in 2008, actually, which, you know, we were risk on prior to 2008, and then we went risk off, basically. So, but this number of 1.2 billion ounces in central banks is not much bigger than it was 15 years ago. You know, I don't remember the exact number. Maybe it was one, but it's been 1.1 billion for a long time, many, many years now. And, you know, that's 15% of the total. This big portion here, jewelry, is half. You got some industrial, which I don't count in my valuations because that's kind of like a constant churn. And then you got bullion, private bullion in the hands of not central banks, but in ETFs, for example, that's 1.7 billion ounces. And if we do that times a rough gold price, that's about $4 trillion worth of gold here. And remember, I said ETFs are 250 billion. So it's such a, ETFs, you can see, are such a small component still of people's private gold holdings. So, you know, I don't know what that portends for the future, but it's just not that, it seems like a liquid market, but it's actually not. Most gold is, you know, it's sitting in the London bullion banks. It's been traded around. You know, yeah, there are a lot of ETFs and whatnot and paper gold derivatives, but you know, there's a lot of gold presumably in, you know, grandma and grandpa's jewelry box and other depository institutions. And it's just not that transparent. It's not that liquid. And I don't really see that ever changing, you know, no matter how much Peter Schiff barks about all this, like the enthusiasm behind Bitcoin is only going to rise. The utility behind Bitcoin is only going to rise. And I just can't see anything like meaningful coming out of this chart where, I don't, even if central banks start buying up a lot, like where, okay, so gold goes, you know, from, you know, little over 2 trillion there to 4, and the price, you know, doubles. That's cool. But, you know, central banks don't really trust each other these days with everything that Russia and Iran and China are doing. If you're going to have this BRICS buck system, are you really, like, do you really want to hold some renminbi so you can have a currency that's kind of backed by gold? But even then, like, are you even sure that that redeemability matters? It's just not, it just doesn't work today, in my opinion. So I have no problem with it. It's a good asset if you want to hedge some things. Certainly there's demand in jewelry. It's half of the gold market. But, you know, 1.2 billion, it's something like 2.5 trillion at the moment in value.
How do we know the jewelry number? Like, how does anyone know that?
So there are a few different institutions that track this stuff. So I got CPM Group, World Gold Council. There are others as well. US Geological Survey. They do some tracking of these different things. But yeah, should be clear. These are my numbers at the end of the day. I do make some estimates about different things, especially over time. This is just a snapshot, like a current snapshot. But generally, this is, if you look at other reports, you're going to find stuff that is generally the same as this. And yeah, it's just a variety. You do look at mining activity, you look at the sources and uses, you look where the gold came from, what it's typically being sold for, who's buying it, who's purposing it, melting it down, or you melting it into bars, jewelry, so on and so forth. And the jewelry is always just the dominant demand. And then in silver, you have about the same, but it's not 50% just jewelry and then bullion. It's 50% jewelry, and the other 50% is industrial. So this is shows you even more how silver's like already checked out as a monetary asset. Like, you got it's here, and then a very small proportion is actually in bullion. There's almost nothing in central banks. The black is in central banks for gold. It's not even worth putting it here. There is some, but it's like, it's so minuscule. It rounds to zero. So you have only 4 billion ounces of the 50, actually it's 60 now, 60 billion ounces of silver. And fully half of that is industrial. You know, so it's in keyboards and laptops and phones and conduits and, you know, circuits and buildings and all that stuff. Just a constant churn. It's absolutely not a monetary value. So when you see my evaluations for silver in dollar terms, it's only these two things, which is jewelry, which also includes silverware, by the way. That's a subset of jewelry. It's a big one. And bullion. So it's like, you know, if you actually break it down that way, if you look at these industries, they don't move that much. And you just look at someone like Peter Schiff trying to act like, you know, blockchain-based gold or holding gold at the Perth Mint is going to be some revolutionary idea. And he's talking his book beyond, you know, just beyond anything that's reasonable.
Yeah, I think it also has an image problem. Setting aside kind of the underlying fundamentals of it, I don't think... It doesn't have the image that is associated with keeping pace with the digital age, right? And so I'm not sure a lot of millennials are going to be or even, you know, younger, are like, are there young gold bugs? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there are some. I've noticed them on Twitter, but much more in Bitcoin, obviously. And it's just, especially my part of the world, man, I just cannot see, you know, a Ukrainian or in some war-torn portion of the Middle East, if you do have any access to capital, it's going to be very difficult for you to get that out as far as gold coins. And, you know, they always used to read these old reports that people would, you know, sew them into their clothes or something, even during World War II. But there's just a much more efficient way to get any wealth that you have out of the country if you got to run. And that's a huge part of it. And I think this shows, again, how gold got captured. Like, silver is just completely worthless as money. So, you know, $4 billion out of $60 billion is actually in coins and bar form. Gold's more, about 50% of it's six. But, you know, huge portion of that, 15%+, is in central banks, 20%. And, you know, what does that do for any sort of durability of your money if you really need to run? I think not much. And on the flip side, you want to just use it as a store of value for your family's wealth into the future, that's fine, but you may run into the same problem that Russia had, having their reserves frozen. And again, I'm no friend of Russia, but the system itself just isn't, there's no trust anymore in the system, and you actually do need some trust to manage a gold standard.
Well, I think a lot of people just look for the least bad option, but what you see that's, you know, well established is the authoritarian countries with, you know, tight attempts at capital controls are the ones where the wealthiest in those countries are constantly seeking, you know, opportunities to park assets and capital elsewhere.
Precisely.
And where they tend to park it in, you know, neutral or Western places, right? Like, they're not leaving it at home. And they have to, you know, go through all this. I mean, I think we've talked about it before, the kind of like worst kept secret of the USDT, the Tether trade, you know, moving money out of the mainland through Hong Kong and then into Bitcoin or other assets. And that was like, you know, Alameda was famously involved in that. So, yeah, I mean, I agree the trust is an issue, but it's a relative thing too.
Sure, indeed. But I think Bitcoin's got a lot more future there. This is a breakdown of the different time cohorts of Bitcoin. It's got Satoshi on this side and unmined coins, 1.3 million here. And then the different time cohorts.
That's a good chart.
After a year is here. So 1 to 5 years, 5 to 10, 10 plus. And for the listeners only of this, that's you know, about 13 million coins. And then
any recent updates on the number of lost coins?
Yeah, that's always changing, and I'm not sure, because I think some of those updates or some of those reports have been too severe, and then some maybe too light, so I'm not really sure. But, you know, if you pick 30%, that's what, let's just do that. Yeah, 5.8.
We think 30%?
I think it's high, but I've seen reports that do pick 30%. That's 5.8 million coins.
That would be wild.
But still, I mean, even look here, you have, if you just look at the cohorts, you don't even have to worry about, you know, because this is, again, the beauty of Bitcoin. Like, you don't have to do these random reports that I'm finding to do these kind of rough cohorts of use cases for gold and silver, which are not time-driven. Here you can actually see it. And there's about 6 million coins, which is about 30% of the coins, that haven't moved in over 5 years. So that doesn't mean that they're gone. But, you know, 30% of the asset class hasn't even once moved in over 5 years. That's pretty unbelievable. And 10%, over 10%, is 15% hasn't moved in 10 years, Satoshi included.
Yeah, well, some of that definitely is lost.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. You know, it's I think it's 10 to 20% probably, but I've heard different estimates of that and how it's. I think I linked to a report that was nearly 30% here. If you want to check that out online, but you know, the methodologies change on how this goes. Anyway, that's one, and then the last one here on this top money asset, which is a good one that we added here, was the top 10 stocks in Bitcoin. So obviously more monetary stuff up above, the gold, silver, the state money, monetary based stuff, but a lot of people still like liquid stocks. And unbelievably, BTC is in number 8, the 8th slot. It just fell down below Meta this week. So it topped out at number 7. And the interesting thing is, you look at the top 10 stocks, most of them trade between, say, 0.1% and 0.5% of volume each day. Value of units traded, value of shares traded in Wall Street terms. And we see with Bitcoin and NVIDIA, they trade about 2 to 3%, maybe 1.5%. So you can see the volatility there in Bitcoin and NVIDIA. NVIDIA obviously rose to prominence unbelievably in the last year. Tesla is maybe the 15th stock. That also does that, has that volatility, or that percentage of shares traded, units traded in Bitcoin's case. But that's interesting as well, I think, isn't that there lies some of the volatility in that fraction where you got, you know, 30 to 40 billion dollars worth of the asset traded daily in NVIDIA and Bitcoin, whereas the others, I mean, the Saudi Aramco is fifth largest stock. They have, it rounds to zero. You know, they got like 50 million traded, and obviously its local currency is in Saudi Arabia, Rial. So,
oh, is it not traded on a
US? Nope. It's a Saudi Arabian, native Saudi Arabian company and trade. So, shows you, tells you, it tells you something about the energy markets.
Yeah. Well, and like, you know, liquidity too. Interesting that NVIDIA is right up there with Bitcoin and
Tesla.
I'm sure Tesla is too. I saw the, did you watch the NVIDIA shareholder, like the meeting that was in March? It was a good show. It was a spectacle. And Jensen's he's a pretty good presenter. But the video and audio and music that they generated, it was all AI generated. Mm-hmm. And it was like massively slick.
Nice.
I mean, it was really good. And lots of references to TSMC during that presentation. You know, the trope was like, talk about the NVIDIA chip and then where is it made? Talk about the NVIDIA chip and then, you know, TSMC foundries, right? Like they were tying that connection pretty actively in the course of it.
Yep. It's a very intense market, and it's interesting to see the relationship there and where that goes. Obviously, it's huge. TSMC itself. Yeah.
And Lilly got one pharma company just barely making it up there.
Top 10.
Wow. I wonder what their top selling drug is. That's an interesting chart.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the top money asset page. And then you rank them all in a bar chart as well. You see gold is far and above. Silver is already below Bitcoin, 800 billion. Then we got Bitcoin. Just this is not having stocks, but this has gold and the fiat currencies back ranked. So we just got the top 4 currencies in gold. So it's exciting as we come into the halving here. I think there's, you know, we can keep going with the charts unless you want to talk a little news.
No, do your thing.
Because we got the old power law here. As we come into the halving, you know, it just nipped above the trend line a little bit here in March. It's now dipped below. But it hasn't hit the trend line for how long has it been exactly? It's March 24, and, you know, you can almost call it March 2022. So a little under 2 years when it dipped below. So we're back at it. And obviously it doesn't bother me at all that it fell back down. Again, I'm not a trend, a technical trader or anything, but this just shows you the big picture that it's finally in the right direction again. And, you know, if you look out to the halving, or excuse me, to the four-year cycle, presumably end of 2025, that's $120,000 Bitcoin. One sigma up 270, two sigma up 800, which would be wild. Not putting it past it, but last time we hit two sigma was in 2017.
Yeah, it would take a lot more money in to get there, though. It's not the same.
Agreed.
But we've been surprised before.
Yeah. So, you know, that's that. I got a few others. I don't know if you want to keep going or.
Sure. Yeah. I know you love your charts. I don't want to get in the way.
I do. Most of these have, we've done some recent episodes on the dailies on the YouTube. So followers of that can see more there. But I got the old M3 money supply, which isn't published anymore. So I published my own. The Fed stopped publishing it in 2006. Although with the data that is out there, still from the Fed, you can kind of recreate it without a few different things. And the main thing there is Eurodollars. Eurodollars is basically dollars in offshore banks. So they had a small, like, very small amount, something like $400 billion was their Eurodollar number in 2006. Meanwhile, the M3 itself, when they stopped publishing, which is right about, let's say here, February 2006, was $12.5 trillion. Actually, their M3 was a little bit different because I'm backdating this and using different values, but theirs is maybe like $10 trillion. Bottom line, Euro dollars are probably huge. That's offshore dollars. You know, you think Panama Papers, $20 trillion worth of wealth. Doesn't mean it was all in offshore dollar accounts. Could be in stocks, bonds, or everything, but a lot of it certainly was. So working on some proxies to do a euro dollar supply, but that's a long way out still. But this is M3, so it includes, like, you know, time deposits, money market funds, all these things.
I would think money market would be a large.
It is. Number. It's huge. And it's a huge part of it. Repos as well are a huge part. That's about $7 trillion of this, repurchase agreements. And the Fed lost control of that as well. But here's what's interesting. They stopped publishing it in 2006, probably because they lost control of euro dollars, probably because they lost control of the repo market. But if you look at this chart, try to imagine a line, like a trend line from here, and then look to where it's gone. So from 2008 peak, where it's $16 trillion, it's gone. A huge bump during COVID, but would you say that the trend before 2008 was steeper than, say, the all-time trend or not? What do you think?
I feel like it's a trick question, but it looks steeper now.
Trick question. I'll put it on. Look at this. This is the trend line until 2008. So this trend would, like, it stops calculating basically and just extrapolates based on this data.
Yeah.
So you can see it fits pretty well. Fits really well, actually. The curve, you know, it's a little bit hot in the 80s, then went down in the 90s of 2008, but it peaked there. And it, this actually surprised me too, if you fully run the trend line and everything, is just apples to apples, making your own, all the money supply in the United States.
How is that even possible?
Quite a bit less. Yeah. Well, I think that a lot of the dollar liquidity remains outside of the U.S. in euro dollars is one thing.
But that's included in M3, though.
It's not included in my M3. It's out.
Oh, I see.
So this says M3X stablecoins, euro dollars. Stablecoins is also a M3 type money now, but obviously that didn't exist in 2008. And now it's still very small. So the other thing to learn from this, I think, is how much cash and cash-like instruments there is compared to even stablecoins. Like, forget Bitcoin even. But stablecoins, which are clearly, they're like a money market fund, basically. You know, it's like someone gives you a token, and then that person that you gave money to buy that token is buying an interest-earning asset with it to take a spread.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly what a money market fund does. But stablecoins are like 100, you know, Tether's $100 billion of $150 billion market, something like that. This is The M3 that I calculate is $35 trillion. And this is just the U.S., right? You got euros, you got yen, yuan. So it's wild. There's a lot of money sloshing around the system. And it is interesting, though, that the rate of growth from 2008 has been less. You know, I think there's a lot of regulation that plays into that. You know, money market funds were just going crazy, like mortgage-backed securities, all those things. That all played into this trend. But then if you look at the trend post 2008, it's like way lower. And if you extrapolate them both, the post 2008 trend says we'll be at 50 trillion by 2030. The pre 2008 trend says we'll be at 100 trillion. I think that the reality, and I didn't actually draw the full trend, which definitely is in the middle. I'm not sure exactly what it is at the moment why I'm doing this. It's probably something like 70 trillion. Because it's going to take into account both, where these specifically don't. It's just looking at before and after. But it also just shows you the power of compounding. Like, you put it in log scale, they become straight lines. Like, this is a trend. It's hard to fight the Fed. It's hard to fight money printers here. And even if it goes at 50 trillion over the next 6 years, or goes up to 100 trillion, you know, it's only, quote, only growing at 6% in the first case, 8.5% per year in the second case, doubles, you know, a little over and a little less than every 10 years. So I think it still looks very good for hard assets that protect you against this, which, again, until 2008, we didn't have Bitcoin. So I think it looks good.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
And why did you? Why is euro dollars excluded?
Because it's very difficult to calculate.
Is it?
Yeah. Okay. The Federal Reserve did their best, and remember that number euro dollar itself is only like 400 billion now. In 2008 when they stopped publishing in it, but now, I mean, I've seen estimates that euro dollar market could be 30 trillion. I've seen estimates it could be like 60 trillion, even more.
Really?
Yeah. Because people want dollars still. Even, you know, when COVID happened, people wanted dollars. When 2008 happened, people wanted dollars. And the Federal Reserve stopped publishing it. It's the most insane thing that the central bank could do, is that you're the director of the monetary system. Like, you are the monetary authority. You're supposed to have control of the money supply. And in 2006, you decide to stop publishing it. It's unbelievable. And
It doesn't mean they stopped tracking it.
Well, I actually, every single piece of data here that I have calculated and created and done these sort of back tests with comes from the Fed itself. So I can get you something that's close, but I don't have this, in my opinion, this X factor, which is euro dollars. And I think that's probably exploded. You know, all around the world, banks that are just outside the jurisdiction of the Federal Reserve. You know, you see that in a small way with what happened with stablecoins. But again, it shows you how huge the banking system is. You know, this ties into sanctions. This ties into everything else. Like, this is the squeeze that they keep trying to put on everybody in the world by keeping their dollar important and relevant and strong. And taking a moment to remind you that this show is brought to you by Trezor, home of the original Bitcoin hardware wallet. For over 10 years now, Trezor means business in Bitcoin security and functionality. When using their wallet software, Trezor Suite, to connect to the Bitcoin network, you're automatically connected via Tor, protecting your identity and giving you full control of your coins in a fully open source manner, both on the software level and on the hardware level. So head on over to Trezor.io to grab your Trezor Safe 3 with a secure element, Model T with a touchscreen, or the original Trezor 1, as well as a ton of available accessories to back up your keys and keep your coins safe. This show is proud to be associated with Trezor. Yeah, we're really seeing a tension here and perhaps a split with Russia, China, and Iran, and maybe to a lesser extent, India. So that'll be interesting to see, but yeah, I'm working on some proxy money supplies for it, like looking at public stock data. I'm working on it. It's taking some time, but yeah, it's a huge disservice to like economists and people that would like to study money growth that they do not publish it themselves. I think it's a big shame.
Yeah. Where are you on the viability of BRICS?
Not very at all.
Yeah. Why? I mean, I agree, but I'm just curious.
Yeah. I mean, I think the values of the West still are far and away better. Now, I know there's a lot of people listening to this show and a lot of Bitcoiners in general that are pretty cynical, contrarian, as Peter said on our last show. But I would even, in this sort of escalating world of hot wars that we're seeing around the world, I don't think that you're going to, if you're going to just talk investment, let's forget like sound money for people that, you know, middle-class people, but if you're, or lower middle-class people, if you're just talking investors and safe havens, the United States could, as Peter Todd recommended, and I don't see a problem either, frankly, but the criminal activities of Russia in Ukraine, they could completely confiscate that $300 billion, completely use it, the United States and Europe together collectively, because most of it's in Europe, in fact, right now. Yeah, it's in Euro clear. So they could confiscate it, use it to pay for Ukrainian, you know, reparations, recovery, or just arms. It's a huge amount, $300 billion. I don't think anyone would be throwing their hands up and saying that this is some unprincipled thing. I mean, it's a criminal action, what Russia is doing. It's just what will happen and what, you know, the lower level central banks are saying, well, look, I mean, if you're going to do this to Russia, like maybe, you know, we don't have the cleanest books either. You're going to do this to us. And so you start to, you have this slippery slope effect. So that is a problem. But the argument nonetheless is still being made. We've already paid for Russian war crimes with the interest on the Russian assets. So the interest itself has been confiscated. The interest that is generated on these assets over the last 2 years. So the interest is being used. So it's just another step to say that the actual reserves would be used and the gold, because it's both. But again, all of this bodes very well for Bitcoin. I don't say that in like a selfish investor way. I'm just saying if you think that there is low trust in the world today, it goes back to our gold discussion, and there is, fine, use Bitcoin. But, you know, if you're going to run a criminal regime that steals from its people, 24-year dictatorship, and invades countries, other large government entities are going to stand up to you. And for me personally, obviously our listeners should know that by now where I live. I have no problem with it, but I can certainly see how mid-level countries that don't really have much say in this would be worried, which again bodes well for Bitcoin. So it's kind of a weird situation, but that's where we are.
Yeah, that's a tough dilemma for sure. I actually don't know where I stand on it, to be honest.
I mean, it's a core of the system. We're talking about that, you know, base money that I've been talking about. It's a core of the system for almost 100 years now, since Bretton Woods. So I understand if people are thinking that this would be arbitrary or whatnot, but there are a lot of lawyers that are looking at it. There are a lot of courts that are looking at it. Bill Browder, who has written some very interesting books on the Putin regime, is a big proponent of it, of course. He also doesn't like Bitcoin, which is also funny. Doesn't understand it, but like this is just where we are, right? I mean, you can't get around the reality of the situation. Like wars back to Europe and Pax Americana is not working. I think it all bodes very well for Bitcoin, but I say that almost kind of cynically. I don't say that with any joy with that, because there's still a lot of people that are suffering and just suffering from these criminal regimes. So I don't know. I'm talking a lot on that topic. Feel free to wax and wane on it.
Well, no, I mean, there's the model where Bitcoin gains adoption because by attraction.
Yep.
And there's a model where the Bitcoin gains adoption through the failure of its competitors. And I think the latter is not something to root
Correct.
For. That might be the path, right? But we shouldn't root for it. And I do see like some gleefulness, you know, from our community on that. I'm like, that's not going to be just because your Bitcoin might be worth a lot in that scenario. Does not mean that it's something to aspire to. And that's like the chaos model of Bitcoin ascent. So yeah, I don't subscribe to that as being a future that we should hope for, but it's possible for sure.
There's a good book. It's called So You Want a Revolution. Can't remember the author at the moment, but the it goes through a few, you know, French Revolution, Russian Revolution, goes through some good ones that didn't really pan out so well for the common man. And it certainly seems like we're tiptoeing around these conflicts now. And, you know, again, there's theory and then there's practice. Like, if you really want to revolt against the system, you better be careful what you're going to get. And, you know, I think the younger that you are, you might root for that. The older that you are with family, you might less so. And the world's just going by all the same. So I agree with you. It's not something to root for. And I felt the same way about other, you know, like gold bugs used to say that as well. Like gold was just going to the moon or something. Like, first of all, if we're going to be trading gold, pieces of gold metal back and forth, like no one wants to do that anyway. No one, you know, people hate cash now. So why would they want to do that with gold? And so that's why I never understood the gold bug argument. But even the Bitcoin argument about, you know, the SEC coming in to regulate Ethereum or something because it's a security, like, that shouldn't be part of the ethos either. Like, I'm not a huge believer in Ethereum, but...
Yeah, I don't... It's I don't know what the word... It's, like, just kind of obtuse and mean-spirited. Yes. not
perverse cheerleading.
Thoughtful.
You might not necessarily like the outcomes of what you're going to get.
Yeah, I get it. What's going on? What's the latest in your great continent on the crackdown on carrying cash? I feel like every time I see a news story, it's like a smaller number that you're allowed to have.
It's a good question. I don't have an update for you in Europe, but cash in general is rising. Go ahead. I'll pull up a cash chart if you got.
Oh no, I was going to say like the last one, I think didn't the French come out with like it was like 2,000 euro or something, or anything more than that was illegal to carry?
Probably. No, that sounds correct. I don't know the latest on that.
1,000 euro. Yeah. 1,000 euro.
It's absolutely insane. And I saw the one out of Canada. Did you see that where they like basically did a KYC on the person?
No.
This Canadian was trying to take out cash. Like the machine was basically doing a KYC. Like, where are you going to spend this money? How are you going to spend it? Do you have a...
Oh my god. Just say it. It's on heroin. So according to this Google search, which is obviously accurate, but it says so France has one of the lowest cash payment limits with only 1,000 euro, you know, soon to be enough for dinner. And there are countries in the EU with no limit at all, and they are Estonia, Finland, Ireland, Cyprus, Luxembourg, Malta, Germany, Austria, and Sweden. Not a bad list.
Not a bad list, yeah. Cash was...
You can get around there.
...highly used around the Baltics, I can say, for a long time. No doubt that people do try to skirt some taxes there, but that's also what happens when you have high taxes, and we had very high social taxes and personal income taxes. I noticed Lithuania and Latvia are not on that list, unfortunately, but regardless, I think it's all part of what the digital euro is coming to and what they're going to try to do. But I still see, I can't find the chart at the moment, but we'll update the listeners some point. I still see cash just as a general trend. It is still being printed, even though they're saying these things. So I think that's quite interesting. It might be that it just, you know, the rate of growth of the population is also growing, so they need to print. But my last estimates were still very off there. If you roughly say the world is even growing by like 1% to 2% a year, cash was still growing by 9-10% a year. So it's like, It doesn't make sense to me, and it doesn't jive with those articles in general understanding. So again, where that cash is going, if it's going to politicians and suitcases and dark rooms, I don't know.
Yeah, but also, like, I don't know the answer there, but how enforceable are these laws? I always get frustrated when I see unenforceable laws, because it's just, you know, the administrative state giving itself a reason to exist. Yeah. But so, like, okay, 1,000 euro. First of all, there's lots of practical applications where that might not even be someone's fault. So if you, you know, in college, I worked in bars. And at the end of the night, the bar always had a fair amount of cash because some people pay in cash. So, you know, the bar would then put that in the safe, and the next morning someone would go deposit that. But you have no control over who pays with credit cards and who pays with cash in that bar, unless you, you know, don't accept cash. But, it, you know, there's a lot of scenarios where 1,000 euro could be on you, right? Or you're traveling or whatever. I just don't get it.
Have you heard of people using Bitcoin in bars these days?
Well, Pubkey. That's the only... I'm sure there's other bars. I think I see more about it in Europe where there's, like, Bitcoin pubs,
yeah,
right?
For sure. I mean, I'm not attuned to the how the service scene is working with Bitcoin, but I can only imagine that will grow as well. And hopefully, you know, as Lightning continues to scale and it gets easier to accept payments, I don't see why that would not. So I have hope. I have hope for those things. But I still am curious because it is growing. Like, they actually keep printing cash, literally physically printing cash, but then they just keep offering or stamping out these just stupid laws. So,
yeah. Well, while we're at it, those of us in the United States find it very frustrating that the euro is comprised of different size notes. So while we're fixing things in the monetary supply, if they could all be the same size, that would be great. I'm fine with the multicolor.
It's supposed to be, yeah, help you understand what's a more expensive thing and what's a cheaper token. It's supposed to help you.
Well, you put a number on the bill and that helps you understand.
They need sizes here, man. Europe is very visually oriented. All the signs, everything, it's positive affirmation. So everything's positive.
Then you've got to organize. It's the small, the fives get lost with the 50s. I mean, come on.
It's asinine. It is asinine.
Yeah. It's upsetting. Yep. I'm sure they say the same thing about our currency. It's like, oh, it's all the same size and the same color. How can you tell the difference?
Well, my friend, if you take a trip to Europe soon, enjoy yourself.
I'm a huge fan of the continent. Did I ever tell the story about Paraguay and the $100 bills?
Not sure.
I'll tell it very quickly. So when I was younger, my family and I, we lived in Paraguay, and this would have been in the mid-90s, and it was when the new $100 bill came out at the time, which was, like, supposedly, you know, the most counterfeit-resistant bill.
Right.
And so Department of Treasury, or I guess probably Secret Service, was in charge at the time, and so they were going around the world... just kind of showing off the new technology. And my dad was working at the embassy in Asuncion, Paraguay at the time. And so they brought in a bunch of Paraguayan bankers to the embassy to be briefed on the new $100 bill, because obviously, you know, maybe not obviously, but Paraguay had a money laundering issue at the time, and maybe still does. And so they took a couple of $100 bills and they passed them around the room so that, you know, these bankers could see it as they're being briefed on it. And the same number did not get returned to the front of the stage at the end. And these are people who are like CEOs of banks in this country. And so, you know, you pass out 10, you get 8 back.
That's the most coveted note, man. $100 bill. Most coveted.
Yeah. That and the $100 trillion Zimbabwe. Yeah. As we've said before, I keep... a one Zimbabwe note and $100 trillion in my office.
There you go.
As a reminder of what's possible.
Indeed. And I think all of this probably is just going to be a happy sideshow eventually to what what Bitcoin's going to do. So it's probably a good way to end it as we move right into the halving of 2024.
I love it. Yeah. The peaceful halving, yeah. The planned reduction of issuance. I'm very bullish on the protocol.
Very exciting. Very exciting. Always enjoy sharing the charts with you, buddy. And I know you got to run.
Likewise. Are you staying up? Are you going to watch the ball drop, or what are you going to do?
There were some parties over here, actually. There was one in Warsaw. Yeah. There's a Santorini party, but I was just doing some travels, actually.
Santorini so, party.
Yeah. Unfortunately, both nice. Sound fantastic, but unfortunately, I'm going to be missing both. So enjoy, you Bitcoiners right. who are there.
Well, we'll toast to it next time we hang out.
All right, my friend. Good catching Cheers. Up. Talk to you soon.